This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's rare for a writer to make the cover of Time magazine, so it was big news in the literary world when Jonathan Franzen was on a Time cover last month before the publication of his new book, Freedom, his first novel since his 2001 bestseller, The Corrections. Then came a front-page review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review that described Freedom as a masterpiece of American fiction. And people started taking sides, before the book was even published, about whether Franzen and his novel were worthy of the praise and attention. Now you can read it for yourself. It was published last week. In a few minutes, Jonathan Franzen will read from and talk about his new novel, Freedom. But first, our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review, along with some thoughts about the critical storm this novel has already stirred up.
Jonathan Franzen is in trouble again. You'll recall that back in 2001, Franzen made the misstep of expressing authorly ambivalence about the fact that his novel, The Corrections, might be mistaken for a women's only read since it had been chosen for Oprah's on-air book club. Soon enough, Oprah booted The Corrections off her syllabus, and Franzen got the reputation in some circles of being a snoot. Now all the hullabaloo over Franzen's long-awaited new novel, Freedom, is generating something of a feminist backlash. Why all this adulatory attention, critics ask, for Franzen's latest domestic drama about marriage and family? So many terrific contemporary female novelists cover the same terrain, yet their work receives a fraction of the highbrow fanfare that greets Franzen. It's like how men still get praise for doing housework and taking care of their own kids. Any male involvement in the domestic realm still merits applause. All true. And yet, even though Franzen gets more praise for doing what many fine women writers do, backwards and in heels, in the case of the blandly titled Freedom, it's well-deserved. I heretically think Freedom is even more powerful than The Corrections, sections of which I found contrived. Freedom is looser and more revelatory and ambitious. It's the novel, by a man, along with novels by women like Allegra Goodman, Lionel Shriver, and the incandescent Sue Miller, that I'd elect to put in a time capsule to give a sense of the texture of middle-class American life to future readers. The husband and wife at the center of scrutiny in Freedom are Walter and Patty Berglund, who meet in college in the 70s. We know that Walter is in for a rough time when we're told at the outset that his most salient quality, besides his love of Patty, was his niceness. Patty, in the opening paragraphs of the novel, is the reigning stay-at-home mom of her gentrified neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota, a crafting and cooking queen. But a crack in Patty's chipper, progressive, democratic demeanor soon surfaces when we learn she slashed the tires of a noisy Republican lout who lives next door. Soon all hell breaks loose as the Berglund's adored teenage son Joey literally defects over the fence to live with the neighbor's vacant and sexually voracious daughter. Even worse, Joey will go on to work for shady civilian contractors supplying defective truck parts to the American forces in Iraq. And then there's Walter's best friend from college, Richard Katz, an aging bad boy and lead singer of an indie band called The Traumatics. Richard turns up erratically in the Berglund's life and simply by his very existence reminds Patty that, although she married Walter, she was only, at best, somewhat more than sort of into him. The unspooling of the Berglunds' marriage as they become more and more their destined selves is chronicled through a variety of perspectives, including a brutal but often hilarious therapeutic memoir that Patty writes, entitled Mistakes Were Made. One of the great pleasures of reading Franzen's work is savoring how he turns personalities this way and that, so that, for instance, from one angle, Patty is a victim. From another, she's a shrewish and controlling depressive. And all interpretations are somewhat true. Even Richard, who could so easily have devolved into a rock and roll stereotype, is dense and surprising. Because he's a cynic, Richard is also the source of some of the sharpest takes on his friends and the world they live in. Midway through the novel, Richard achieves mid-level fame. Here are his thoughts about a young girl who won't stop bothering him. She was like a walking advertisement of the late model parenting she'd received. You have permission to ask for things. Your offerings, if you're bold enough to make them, will be welcomed by the world. Richard wondered if he'd been this tiring himself at 18, or whether, as it now seemed to him, his anger at the world, his perception of the world as a hostile adversary worthy of his anger, had made him more interesting than these young paragons of self-esteem. There's not one throwaway scene in Freedom, and yet for all that effort, nothing feels overwritten or false. Like the corrections, Freedom celebrates and extends the possibilities of the good old realist novel, at a time when realism is out of fashion, even in autobiography. Franzen makes us skeptical postmoderns believe again, if only for a space, that literature really can and should hold a mirror up to the world.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom. Yesterday morning, I spoke with Franzen about the novel and the response to it. Jonathan Franzen, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been just amazing to watch the story in pre-publication play out, Time Magazine, the backlash against your success, before anyone except critics even had a chance to read the book. It's like you're a lightning rod. What's going on?
Well, one thing that's been going on is I think my publishers were tearing their hair out because the books were not in the store and we were getting all the publicity. But that episode is now behind us. What's going on? People seem to be liking the book. I think, you know, at the level of assigning magazine stories and things like that, it's driven by people actually enjoying the book. And I, perhaps in some cases against their will.
What do you mean they don't want to like you?
Well,
I don't want to like this.
You know, the corrections did well, and you sort of tee yourself up on the batting tee to get whacked down, and that's a, you know, who doesn't enjoy doing that as a critic or as an assigning editor? It's fun. It's good sport. So the fact that they haven't felt like doing that is really, really nice, and has, I think, driven a lot of the pre-publicity.
Were you afraid of that with this follow-up to the corrections?
I thought I'd written a book that I might, worst case, have to hand sell. That I have a tour coming up and appearing at maybe 20 venues, and I figured if I could get 200 people at each to listen to a half-hour reading, they might want to read the book, and then it would spread by word of mouth. That was how I imagined it selling as recently as about 6 months ago. Because and going into it, you know, there was all the talk about the rise of the ebook and a general sense on the street that like 2 years ago everyone decided we really don't have to read novels anymore unless they're by Stieg Larsson, and I didn't know what to expect. So it's actually really fun to see that people still are looking for a book that says something about how they're feeling now.
Before we get to the book and a reading from the book, let me just ask you what it's like to be on the cover of Time and what you thought of the photograph. And I'll say the photograph was so austere. It looked like Jonathan Franzen, founding father, or Jonathan Franzen, hip CEO of bank or something. Do you know, it's just like austerity, the kind of picture like you'd see on the wall of an institution, of the founding father of the institution.
Knowing that it was the picture was taken in my garage,
no kidding, really,
with sort of a turpentine-y smell from some old chairs that I was refinishing, put it in perspective. My dad was a big reader of Time magazine, and I was saying last night when I met the editor at Time who made sure that the cover happened, that there was almost nothing I could have done. There's no prize in the world I could have won. I think, you know, meeting the president even would not have impressed him as much as being on the cover. And as that sank in, it became meaningful to me.
Just one more thing about this. There's a certain amount of resentment of your success, I think, by some writers. And it's as if, like, you decided to put yourself on the cover of Time, and who do you think you are? You know, I mean, like, you don't decide to put yourself on the cover of Time. Somebody decides to put you on there.
That's true enough. I haven't been following any of that closely. The little bit that's trickled back to me hasn't sounded particularly ad hominem. It seems like there's a different critique. It's a feminist critique, and it's about the quality of attention that writing by women gets compared to the quality of attention by male writers. And I actually have a lot of those feelings myself and have had over the years.
And I want you to read from the very beginning of the book. It's actually going to start with the second paragraph. Do you want to just set it up before you begin the reading?
It requires only the setup of knowing that in the first paragraph we are told that we are in St. Paul, Minnesota. And this is basically a couple of paragraphs about young gentrifiers in the early 80s in St. Paul. Walter and Patty Berglund were the young pioneers of Ramsey Hill, the first college grads to buy a house on Barrier Street since the old heart of St. Paul had fallen on hard times 3 decades earlier. They paid nothing for their Victorian and then killed themselves for 10 years renovating it. Early on, some very determined person torched their garage and twice broke into their car before they got the garage rebuilt. Sunburned bikers descended on the vacant lot across the alley to drink Schlitz and grill knockwurst and rev engines at small hours until Patty went outside in sweat clothes and said, "Hey, you guys, you know what?" Patty frightened nobody, but she'd been a standout athlete in high school and college and possessed a jock sort of fearlessness. From her first day in the neighborhood, she was helplessly conspicuous. Tall, ponytailed, absurdly young, pushing a stroller past stripped cars and broken beer bottles and barfed upon old snow, she might have been carrying all the hours of her day in the string bags that hung from her stroller. Behind her, you could see the baby-encumbered preparations for a morning of baby-encumbered errands. Ahead of her, an afternoon of public radio, the Silver Palette cookbook, cloth diapers, drywall compound, and latex paint, and then Goodnight Moon, then Zinfandel. She was already fully the thing that was just starting to happen to the rest of the street. In the earliest years, when you could still drive a Volvo 240 without feeling self-conscious, the collective task in Ramsey Hill was to relearn certain life skills that your own parents had fled to the suburbs specifically to unlearn, like how to interest the local cops in actually doing their job, and how to protect a bike from a highly motivated thief, and when to bother rousting a drunk from your lawn furniture, and how to encourage feral cats to defecate in somebody else's children's sandbox, and how to determine whether a public school sucked too much to bother trying to fix it. There were also more contemporary questions like, what about those cloth diapers? Worth the bother? And was it true that you could still get milk delivered in glass bottles? Were the Boy Scouts okay politically? Was bulgur really necessary? Where to recycle batteries? How to respond when a poor person of color accused you of destroying her neighborhood? Was it true that the glaze of old Fiesta ware contained dangerous amounts of lead? How elaborate did a kitchen water filter actually need to be? Did your 240 sometimes not go into overdrive when you pushed the overdrive button? Was it better to offer panhandlers food or nothing? Was it possible to raise unprecedentedly confident, happy, brilliant kids while working full time? Could coffee beans be ground the night before you used them, or did this have to be done in the morning? Had anybody in the history of St. Paul ever had a positive experience with a roofer? What about a good Volvo mechanic? Did your 240 have that problem with the sticky parking brake cable and that enigmatically labeled dashboard switch that made such a satisfying Swedish click but seemed not to be connected to anything? What was that?
That's Jonathan Franzen reading from his new novel, Freedom. So, Jonathan, in this novel, you're in part looking at parenting, and you're looking at it from the perspective of a couple of different generations, you know. And you're looking at, in the case of Walter and Patty Berglund, who you just read about, you're looking at how they were parented and what kind of parents they will become. And I guess I'm interested in why you wanted to write about this kind of arc of family.
The phrase that pops into my mind is becoming one's own parent. which has several meanings. I recently passed the age that my father was when I first knew him as a person. Right around the time he was 50, I start having memories of him. So I find myself, without him around and without parents of my own, feeling like him. And also, since my parents died when I was relatively young, the kind of adult presence in my life that they had provided, I've had to learn to provide myself. And very specifically, I wanted in this book to write about my parents' marriage and their parental experiences as I observe them with myself and my brothers. But I didn't want to set it in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I wanted to set it in times contemporaneous with my own. So in that way, too, I turn my parents into people my age, into people I might be or I might know. And that was the real engine. It was something that came from inside. I mean, I know lots of people with kids, and I've watched my friend David Means's kids grow up from, you know, weighing 9 ounces to now heading off to college this week. But the primary impulse came from within.
There's a part early on when Patty sobs to Walter about her parents, "I hate my family." And Walter valiantly replies, "We'll make our own family." And they do. They have 2 children. And it's like you're capturing here, in a way, the fact that some people decide to have children to do it right because they think their parents did it wrong. And then they realize how hard it is to raise children and not make really big mistakes.
You know, I've been around listening to young parents or would-be parents certainly since I finished college in the early 80s. And it's a refrain you hear. "We're going to do it right this time." You know, Patty's mom never went to her basketball and softball games. Patty's going to be the mom who goes to every single game of her own daughter. You know, her parents ignore her at certain crucial points in fairly brutal ways, and she's going to make herself doubly involved in her own kid's life. And indeed goes off as a pioneer to the new frontier in the early 80s, which is the decayed center of old Midwestern cities, and tries to create a better sort of fairy tale existence apart from the corruption and the disappointments that she'd grown up with on the East Coast.
So she's going to be this active presence in her children's life, the kind of presence that her parents weren't in her life. But for her son, that doesn't really work out. When we read a chapter from her son Joey's point of view, we realize that he resents that she's tried to make him her, quote, boy pal, and confide in him things that are uncomfortable for him to hear, like the fact that she was date raped at the age of 17. And he thinks that she sees his interest in things like Tupac's albums and his favorite TV shows as things that are in competition with her because she wants him to be entertained and fascinated by her. This is his point of view. And the son thinks that his mother has tried to make him her designated understander. Have you seen that phenomenon?
I've lived that phenomenon. I mean, there's a certain in one respect, it was not at all like my own mom, who had practically Victorian notions of propriety, and it was not until the last few years of her life that she really began telling me the kind of stuff that I think younger parents, wisely or unwisely, are confiding to their kids at much earlier ages. But yeah, it's, you know, you see it with the 3 or 4 times a day cell phoning to grown children that parents my age now do. There's a quality of "we are best pals," which is such a contrast to the sharp, heavily enforced distinction between grown-ups and children that I'd grown up with. So I was both channeling something that had happened to me and some of the ways in which I felt oppressed by my mom's needs, but also trying to register it in a contemporary way based on things I'm seeing around me.
Another thing about the parents, Patty and Walter Berglund, in this book, who want to do things differently than their parents did, they don't really know how to be authority figures to their children, especially their son. And Patty complains that her son Joey questions the basis of his parents' authority, and she says, "We make him turn the lights out, but his position is that he shouldn't have to go to sleep until we turn our own lights out, because he's exactly the same as us." And then you describe how Walter, the husband, argues with his son over the difference between adults and children and whether a family is a democracy or a benevolent dictatorship. That's probably an argument you would not have had with your parents. They probably would have been the authority, period.
No, I would have been spanked and sent to bed. And as we're talking, I'm realizing the extent to which the book is a lament for the loss of a distinction between children and grown-ups. So having grown up with this intensely meaningful relationship with my parents and having perceived them so much as different from myself when I was a child, I'm particularly sensitive to the loss of that critical distinction in the culture we have now. And going further, I just finished reading Michael Lewis's terrific book, The Big Short, and there's this great line at the end where one of the traders who actually made a lot of money on the financial crash of 2 years ago says, yeah, we kept expecting the grown-ups to step in at some point and put an end to the fraudulence. And at a certain point, we realized there are no grown-ups. It goes all the way to the top. And I was hoping with this book to allow some people to become adults. And the key moment of becoming an adult, the difference, one of the defining differences between an adult and a kid is that adults relinquish a certain kind of freedom. You can't lie around on your bed all afternoon, and you can't be possibly any number of things. You have to only be one thing or a couple of things.
Do you feel like an adult?
Strangely, in the last couple of years, yes, I have come to feel like an adult. I don't really even know when it happened. It's only very recently.
Well, how old are you?
I'm 51, but I still felt like a teenager in many ways as recently as a couple of years ago.
What changed?
Suddenly, I wrote this book. I think it's occurring to me now is probably the biggest thing that changed. There was the death of my friend David Wallace. Might have been a part of that as well.
This is the writer, and he
committed
David Foster
Wallace. Yeah, a couple of years ago. It wasn't enough to lose my parents. I still was the angry, rebellious teenager who occasionally stepped into the, you know, stern parental role and wrote somewhat forbidding essays about let's not be kids anymore, let's try to write more adult fiction. But in the main, as I walked down the street, continued to feel at some level like I was maybe not 16, but 23. And that feeling has suddenly disappeared, and I'm noticing it now because the last month has been kind of crazy with the pre-publicity and publicity for the book. And as I sit here this morning talking to you, I'm noticing I feel more like a single person, not a person divided between a teenager and an old man. I feel actually about 51. It's shocking.
So what role did the suicide of your friend, the writer David Foster Wallace, have in forcing you or allowing you to cross the line into feeling like an adult?
Death looks different when you see it in a parent or somebody of your parents' age than when you see it in a contemporary or a dear friend who's even a couple years younger. It was a limited closeness, but it was a very intense closeness we had as writer buddies, and it was played out mostly in biweekly telephone calls, and I had the sense that I could pick up the phone, call him, and anything I was feeling, however strange, that had to do with the writing life or negotiating some position for oneself in the culture, all I had to do was start a sentence, and he would finish the sentence and say, yep, and I would do the same for him. And to suddenly have that end and know it was never coming back and feel that as an irreparable loss, the world was no longer opening up ahead of me. I was the surviving person suddenly. I was the person carrying on. And, you know, coinciding approximately with turning 50 and feeling how fortunate I was to still be alive and how fortunate I was to still have the capacity to write, I think that had a lot to do with that sudden turn toward feeling my own age.
So reading your book, I get the impression that you think of depression as like one of the defining epidemics of our time. two of the main characters have it, or at least two of the main characters have it. Patty, who's the main wife mother, actually writes an autobiography at the suggestion of her therapist, and a couple of chapters in the book, in your book, are chapters of this autobiography that she's written. I want to ask you to do a reading here about depression, and this is from the point of view of Richard, one of the main characters in your book, who is an indie rock songwriter, singer, guitarist.
Yes, who has recently had the traumatic experience of moderate success, and it's particularly galling to him, having been on the margins for so long. Not galling, disorienting, and in a weird way depressing, to find himself on NPR, which is a distinction between him and me. I'm very happy to be here. I'm just talking about this disorientation following a certain amount of success. Katz had read extensively in popular sociobiology, and his understanding of the depressive personality type and its seemingly perverse persistence in the human gene pool was that depression was a successful adaptation to ceaseless pain and hardship. Pessimism, feelings of worthlessness and lack of entitlement, inability to derive satisfaction from pleasure, a tormenting awareness of the world's general crappiness. For Katz's Jewish paternal forebears, who'd been driven from shtetl to shtetl by implacable anti-Semites, as for the old Angles and Saxons on his mother's side, who'd labored to grow rye and barley in the poor soils and short summers of northern Europe, feeling bad all the time and expecting the worst had been natural ways of equilibrating themselves with the lousiness of their circumstances. Few things gratified depressives, after all, more than really bad news. This obviously wasn't an optimal way to live, but it had its evolutionary advantages. Depressives in grim situations handed down their genes, however despairingly, while the self-improvers converted to Christianity or moved away to sunnier locales. Grim situations were Katz's niche, the way murky water was a carp's.
What did you want to write about depression in your novel?
People who have a depressive cast of mind are usually the funniest people you meet. And there's nothing like putting a couple of Eeyores into the text to make it at least a little bit funny. What else? Why did I want depressives in here? It's, you know, most interesting people become somewhat depressed at some point in their life. And I'm not writing books for people whose lives are perfectly great. People whose lives are perfectly great probably don't need to read books like the kind I write. Only if you have some regular connection with some kind of darkness or difficulty or conflict does serious fiction begin to matter. And so it's simply realistic to let people, as the stories of their lives build toward dramatic peaks, to enter these dark woods from time to time. And it's really as simple as that. And then because I think it tends to be funny up to the point where you need to be hospitalized.
yeah, that's a riot.
And I know that's no joke. And it's important to make that distinction, that there is, you know, a major depression that really shuts you down. Anything that brings you in the neighborhood of suicide, anything that suggests hospitalization, that's really a different animal altogether. But the much larger body of people who experience some depression in this country are doing it in ways that are feeling it in ways that are very much intertwined with the narrative of their lives.
Sometimes I feel like the philosophy I was brought up with is summed up by the Mel Brooks song, "Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst." And I'm wondering if you were brought up with that philosophy.
I don't even know if I was brought up with it. I certainly witnessed it in my father, and just suddenly it began to be genetically expressed in me. I think about the time I finished college, which was the early Reagan years when there was a dark nuclear shadow over everything. And I didn't have to be taught. It didn't have to be modeled for me. It was really almost hardwired.
So Patty, in your book, sees the therapist and at the therapist's suggestion writes an autobiography. Was that advice you ever got? I mean, you'd be writing one way or another. You don't need a therapist to tell you to write.
I wanted to write long before I was in need of therapy. But having said that, much of the work on a novel for me consists in the kind of work you might do in a paid professional's office of trying to walk back from your stuck, conflicted, miserable place to a point of a little bit more distance from which you can begin to fashion some meaningful narrative of how you got to the stuck place. And the stuckness for the working novelist, or at least for this one, has to do with not wanting to get into certain intensely fraught or private experiences, feeling that it's absolutely necessary to say things that are absolutely unsayable. I kept trying through much of the last decade to access these subjects, these dreamlike relations with important people from my past in direct ways, or I would try to get a character who is sort of like me and had gone through a marriage like I had, or who had had parents like I had, or had witnessed a marriage like my parents had, and the characters kept collapsing into me, and then I would be overcome with shame and also a wish not to bear every aspect of my private life, and I would shut down. So there's a lot of self-psychoanalysis, certainly, that goes into the work, and along the way, becoming depressed, although it certainly feels lousy, comes to be a key and important symptom. It's a flag, and it's almost as if when I start to crash, I know I'm getting somewhere because it's being pushed to a crisis. My whole brain is just like on the brink of shutting down because it's so unhappy with the direction I'm taking things. And
it's interesting that pushes you to another place as opposed to leading you in a paralysis of depression.
Right. Well, like I say, I my father had that Mel Brooks slogan as the refrain of his life. But there was another parent on the scene, and you know, my mother just had boundless energy, and she had a much harder life than my father did in many ways. She had bad health all her life, and she would get down, but she would just muster from somewhere this Apollonian ability to go on, and so I thankfully could always step back right at the brink, and it never turned into, you know, major clinical episodes.
So it sounds like for you, writing a novel is hard work, not only because you're creating characters and coming up with the right words and organizing the plot and all of that, but because you're thinking really hard about contradictions in your own life and trying to work them through in some transformative way in the novel?
Certainly, yeah. That's the brief. If I'm just writing about something moderately interesting in using interesting, well-turned sentences, it just has no life. It's got to come out of something that's some issue that's still hot in me, something that is distressing me. And there are plenty of things to be distressed about. And for a long time, I was able to get a lot of energy onto the page from certain kinds of political distress, environmentalist distress, even aesthetic distress, you know, sort of a war on certain strains in literary fiction that I was opposed to. And that kind of anger has become less interesting to me because it seems like a younger man's game a little bit. And also, the writer is still too well defended. You are armored in your anger. And particularly in the new book, I tried to let go of that, or I found myself letting go of it, and went to the deeper, more upsetting things, which were much harder to get onto the page, but whose presence I could feel. I could feel like some you know, pool of magma beneath the crust, that there is heat down there. If I can only find a way to tap into it, it will make the pages hot in the way they have to be.
You said before that you wanted to be able to say the unsayable in your novel, and I'm wondering if you could give an example of something that you've written that you thought of as being unsayable.
The great thing about novels, and the reason we still need them, I think we'll always need them, is you're converting unsayable things into narratives that have their own dreamlike reality. And instead of having factual statements about what is, here's the factual statement I will never make about myself, I can't make about myself, I'm too ashamed or afraid to make about myself. If that can be translated into characters who feel like they have some independent life, and if they're embodying through their story that informational material about myself, then I feel as if it's been not quite said, but it's been enacted. And if you want an example, I would say what happens to Patty and Walter's son, Joey, in the course of the book. In spite of how adamantly he's asserting that he's on the same level as his parents, at a certain point, the story, the world, puts him in a position where he doesn't know what to do. And suddenly there comes welling up all of these feelings about both of his parents, maybe particularly his mother, that he's just not prepared to handle. And even though the content that comes welling up in him is not quite my content, that experience of being the very well-defended young man who's nonetheless sitting on this impossible stuff, desperately trying to keep it under control, that enacted something that came as close to saying the unsayable as I could in that regard.
Jonathan Franzen, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel is called Freedom. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Katy Perry released a single in May that became what many people agree was the pop hit of the summer, a song called California Girls, which is different from the Beach Boys song. California Girls is on Perry's new album, Teenage Dream. Last week, Teenage Dream was number one on Billboard's 200 top-selling albums. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says Teenage Dream is just one part of what he calls the Katy Perry art project. Here's his review.
You make me feel like I'm losing my virginity. The first time, every time when you're touching me.
If I say that for Katy Perry, choosing the right color for a wig or the shape of a high heel for a photo shoot is very nearly as important as what beat to use in a song, I don't intend this as an insult. It's Perry's self-consciousness, her awareness of herself as a complete package, that makes her interesting. That, combined with the air of playfulness that makes sure she doesn't come off as either overtly cynical or shrewdly manipulative in the Madonna manner. Well, all that and the fact that many of her songs sound awfully good. Lush, lustily sung, creamy canvases against which her image and her voice can pose.
My Valentine, Valentine.
Perry wants to be a lot of people's teenage dream. She cited influences that literal teenagers may not recognize these days, Elizabeth Taylor, Jane Russell, but teenagers at heart who know the history of the good girl art tradition Perry's media appearances are referencing can't help but be charmed. I don't think Perry's take on California girls exceeds the Beach Boys, but neither does Perry. For her, the phrase California girls is less about summoning up a state of mind than it is some combination of anthem and a celebration of celebrity. Specifically, it's about what it's like to hang out with Snoop Dogg, who makes a vocal cameo, and by implication, what it's like to introduce your new boyfriend-fiancé, British actor-comedian Russell Brand, to the California lifestyle.
Greetings, loved ones. Let's take a journey.
I know a place where the grass is really greener. Warm, wet and wild. There must be something in the water. Sipping gin and juice. Laying underneath the palm trees.
Yeah.
And
Katy Perry Art Project includes having artist Will Cotton execute a portrait of Perry swaddled in cotton candy clouds. It includes turning her relationship with Russell Brand into ongoing performance art at public appearances. And it includes the creation of clever pop songs, such as the cute decadence of a song like Last Friday Night, in which Katy can say that she woke up smelling like a mini bar and still seems bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Plus, it's nice to hear the syllables of a couplet such as, I think I need a ginger ale, that was such an epic fail, click into place.
There's a stranger in my bed, there's a pounding in my head, glitter all over the room, pink flamingos in the pool, I smell like a mini bar, DJ's passed out in the yard, Bobby's on the barbecue, this a hickey or a bruise, pictures of last night ended up online, I'm screwed.
Perry's album has its serious moments, extravagantly emotional ballads in which the 25-year-old gets in touch with her inner 15-year-old. From these, some of us avert our ears. Most of the time, however, Teenage Dream is an album that suggests you can will yourself into happiness, into romance, into offering a pop art alternative to competition that not only includes Lady Gaga, but Eminem and Arcade Fire. Aware of music as an art project, Perry is clearing some territory for herself. She's staking her claim by pouting at the camera, stamping a high heel into the soft center of the music industry, and singing in a clear, strong voice about how exhilarating it is to be clear and strong about what you want.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Katy Perry's new album, Teenage Dream. She'll perform on the season opener of Saturday Night Live, September 25th. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.